Let's Talk Outdoors is recorded on the homelands of many nations, including the Cree, Soto, Assiniboine, Dene, Dakota, Lakota, Nakota, and Métis nations on the Treaty 6 and Treaty 4 territories. We encourage you to always learn more about the stories of the land on which you live, work, and play.
Hi, I'm Leah.
And I'm Derek, and this is Let's Talk Outdoors. Today, we're talking to Greg Fenty.
Greg shares about his experiences with the Young Naturalist Program, bird research and banding in Saskatchewan, and the Bluebird Trail.
Welcome to the podcast, Greg. Can you start by telling us maybe a bit about your background and your involvement in outdoor and environmental education?
Oh, boy. Okay. I've always sort of been an outdoor kind of person. My parents were very outdoor oriented and just doing things like canoeing and backpacking, that sort of thing from an early age. When I went through university, I kind of gravitated towards geography. I always thought geography was what the National Geographic magazine was all about. And there's got to be some fun stuff to do that way.
Yeah.
When I graduated from university, I got a job as a research tech with Environment Canada, and that took me all over Canada, primarily really cool spots in the high Arctic and throughout northern Canada. The unfortunate part about working with the government is you're at the whim of whatever political party happens to be in power, mm-hmm. and whether or not they're environmentally friendly or not. So unfortunately, I got downsized in 1992. While I was doing all this, though, I managed to come back to Saskatoon in about 1989 and bought a house here in Saskatoon. That was my home base that I could actually store my stuff. Living in a duffel bag,
yeah.
You know, when you graduate university, just doesn't work. And when I came back to Saskatoon, I was able to get involved in all sorts of different community organizations, like the Roadrunner organization, the Canoe Club, the Saskatoon Zoo Society, and that really opened up a lot of really interesting connections for me with especially the Nature Society. That's where I started hanging out with Dr. Stuart Houston and Mary Houston. And if you're familiar with those names, they were bird bander extraordinaires, and wound up in my spare time bouncing all over Saskatchewan, banding hawks and owls and turkey vultures and all kinds of different birds and raptors with Stuart Houston. And all the while, Mary Houston telling me about the plants and the birds and everything else that was out there. It was a really neat opportunity to learn about Saskatchewan, and especially birds of prey, that sort of thing.
No kidding.
And around the same time, volunteering with the Saskatoon Zoo Society, they got in a orphaned Swainson hawk in about 1992 or so. And because I was working with raptors with Dr. Houston, I got involved with this little imprinted hawk at the zoo and started developing education programs around it. At the time, there's a wonderful woman, Melanie Elliott, programming the education programs at the zoo. And we just went with it and developed. We had a socialized Swainson hawk doing hundreds of thousands of classroom presentations over the 23 years that the hawk actually lived.
Wow.
And it was pretty amazing. Yeah. And then Melanie Elliott left the Zoo Society and went to the University of Saskatchewan Extension Division and started something called the Ecology Club for Kids. And I just kind of followed Melanie over there, and we started doing the Ecology Club, which was a twice a month, every second Saturday of the school year, we get a group of kids together on campus to learn about ecology. And the really cool part was we'd access to all the scientific parts of the university and professors and that sort of thing. And we were able to develop some really, really interesting education programs based on the Ecology Club for Kids.
That's cool.
Yeah. eventually, my volunteering with the Zoo Society, I kind of just volunteered myself into a job. So after 10 years of volunteering with them, I spent the next 20 years developing education programs with the Saskatoon. Bond with them, and they would become very socialized. So I was able to work with things like foxes and all sorts of raptors, short-eared owls, barred owls, great horned owls, Swainson hawk, red-tailed hawks, snakes, reptiles, that sort of thing, and develop a whole series of classroom presentations for schools, talk about habitat, endangered species, that sort of thing. And it was a lot of fun because being under the tutelage of Melanie Elliott, it was very, very science-based as opposed to, a lot of the animal presentations you see these days are very fluffy, you know, come meet the animal and pet it and that sort of thing. So we were able to do some really heavy-hitting science with the presentations we did. And that continued right up until I basically lost my hearing in 2016. Going back into time, hanging out with Mary Houston, bouncing around Saskatchewan, she was also very much into bluebirds and tree swallows. And she organized a program with the Nature Society called the Young, or actually the Junior Naturalists. And I got involved with the Junior Naturalist with Mary, helping her doing the monitoring and banding of bluebirds and tree swallows along the Saskatoon portion of the Bluebird Trail. And that's got a real history in itself as well. That dates back to almost the 1940s in Saskatchewan. Eventually, Mary retired in 2009 and asked if I would take over the whole banding program, to which I said yes. So that was the other big thing in my life was learning, becoming a master bander and taking over the whole bird banding program from Mary Houston. When I started employment with the Zoo Society back in the mid-90s or so, I was already doing a lot of volunteer work with the Saskatoon Nature Society, and especially with the Young Naturalist program that they had. And I started something similar with the Zoo Society called the Nat Pack. And then I quickly realized that I was just reinventing the wheel. I was doing the same program for the Nature Society that I was doing with the Zoo Society. So I approached the Zoo Society and said, would you like to combine this program with the Nature Society? It was great because I could volunteer my time with the Nature Society and use my employment time with the Zoo Society to actually develop the programs. So it worked out really, really well. So we changed the name from the Junior Naturalist and the Nat Packs to become the Young Naturalist. And I've been doing that now for almost 30 years now. So it's doing programs with the Nature Society. And it's been a lot of fun.
No kidding. That's amazing. Can we backtrack for a second here? Because you talked about bird banding, and I have no concept of how you would go about banding a bird. So you like expand on that a little bit?
There's different ways of doing it. So what a bird band is, it's essentially, the way I explain it to kids, it's a birth certificate for a bird. We have a birth certificate that tells you where you were born, when you were born. You can carry that in your pocket or your wallet. And birds don't have pockets or wallets. So we give them a little band that goes around their leg. It's got a very unique number on it that gets entered into a big database, the Canadian Bird Banding Lab. And you can look up this information on when the bird was banded, where it was banded, and you get an idea if you ever catch the bird again. How old it is, how long it's lived, how far it's traveled, that sort of thing. There's a whole variety of information you can get off bird banding. And there's a bunch of different ways you can go about bird banding. The most traditional way is to set up a series of nets, very, very fine nets called mist nets. And if you ever get the opportunity, there's a banding station run by Nature Saskatchewan at Last Mountain Lake. And it's a series of 10 nets, and basically Birds, especially during migration period, but during the summer as well, birds will fly into the net, and then you get special training on how to extract them without hurting them, that sort of thing. Once you've got a bird in your hand, you can do things like take all sorts of different measurements. You learn how to sex the bird. The bird's feathers are like our clothes. When our clothes wear out, we need to replace them. And when birds replace their feathers, they do it in a very specific sequence. So when you catch a bird in your hand, you can actually look at the feathers for what we call molt limits, changes in the feathers, and you can age a bird, usually up to about 2 years of age, sometimes three. Once they're beyond 3 years of age, they pretty much replaced all their feathers and you can't really tell how old they are. But when you get a bird in your hand, you take all sorts of different measurements, weight, wing length, feather length. You can possibly tell their age. You can tell their sex. Definitely do the species. It's a great way to learn your bird species by having birds in the hand up close. And you give them a number, leg band, record all the information. You'll see that bird again someday down the road, or somebody will see that bird again someday down the road. So mist nets are one of the easiest ways, or more the traditional way of catching a bird, to put a band on it. The stuff I would do with Stuart Houston involved finding a hawk nest or an owl nest, and baby hawks and baby owls can't fly until they're about 6 weeks of age. So you find a hawk nest or an owl nest that's got young birds in it. You climb up the tree, much to the annoyance of mother owl or mother hawk. So you have to wear all sorts of interesting protective gear, helmets and face shields and thick leather jackets and that sort of thing to fend off any attacks. You climb up into the nest and visit the babies, put some leg bands on them, record their sizes, that sort of thing, and then hopefully climb down out of the tree unscathed. The bluebirds and tree swallows are really interesting to do because I can involve kids with this as well. And that's why the bluebird trail tends to be a really, really big part of what the junior naturalist and the young naturalist are doing. And you've probably, as you drive around rural Saskatchewan, you've probably seen birdhouses on fence posts everywhere throughout rural Saskatchewan. And a lot of those date back to the 1940s, 1950s, 1960s, when bluebirds and tree swallows started showing a sharp decline in population changes, mainly because of lack of habitat and introduction of things like European starlings and house sparrows, which also nest inside cavities, inside hollow trees. So birds that nest inside cavities, woodpecker holes, that sort of thing, like things like chickadees, house wrens, tree swallows, bluebirds, that sort of thing, they were showing a decline. So the idea was you make an artificial hollow tree, a birdhouse, and you put it up all over the place. And then you can actually visit these birdhouses and look inside and see if they're being occupied. So that's what we do. We set up different bluebird trails throughout Saskatchewan. And during the hatching season, roughly late May to mid-July, you just walk up to the nest, put your hand over top of the on the birdhouse. And our birdhouses are specially designed that you can open them up. So you can just open up the side or the top, look in and check out what species is in there, if there's eggs, if there's babies. And if the babies are the right age, we can put leg bands on them as well. And sometimes you catch an adult that's sitting on the eggs. And if you catch an adult sitting on the eggs, you can put a band on him or her as well. And the nice thing is, a lot of times, and the amazing thing is, actually, this is the amazing part I find about it. If you catch a bird and put a band on it in a nest box, there's a really, really good chance you're going to find that bird 2 or 3 years down the road in the very, very same nest box. These birds migrate thousands of kilometers south down to the, the United States-Mexican border, and then come back to basically the same house that they were hatched in. It's just incredible navigation, and that's the fascinating part. And we find the same things, like when we run there's different bird banding stations. There's things like what's called a MAP station, monitoring avian productivity and survivorship. And I think there's one left in Saskatchewan that Jared Clark still runs, but we had one in Saskatoon as well. It's a series of five, and you catch something like a chickadee or whatever in net number one, and you catch that same chickadee or waxwing or robin or whatever in net number one 2 or 3 years later. And that tells you that the birds that migrate, chickadees don't migrate, but if it was a migratory bird, they're migrating to wherever they migrate to, Costa Rica or wherever, and they're basically coming back to the same tree to be caught in the same net again. It's pretty fascinating stuff.
Wow.
That's way better navigational skills than I have.
I'm just amazed where I need, you know, my Google Maps to get through a strange city, and here these birds are, you know, migrating thousands of kilometers through all sorts of weird weather and habitat changes, and they make it back. I'm always, you know, they always say something like welcome back or glad you made it when you catch a bird that's wearing a band.
So you mentioned that the bird aspect is a big part of the Young Naturalist program. What other kinds of things are involved?
We do a whole bunch of things as well, and we try to relate them all together. So the bird banding is the core project. It's our main conservation education project that the Young Naturalists do. But we also do things like pond dipping, looking for underwater aquatic invertebrates, that sort of thing. And most people, especially we're dealing with kids, they don't realize things like dragonflies and mosquitoes and horseflies and all these things that buzz around us. They start off as aquatic larvae in ponds. And so we spend a lot of time doing pond dipping exercises as well, seeing what we can find in some of the local ponds. And that way they get to see what the food for bluebirds and tree swallows, where it starts off, and hopefully put that connection together in terms of how important wetlands are to the whole biodiversity of things that are beyond the wetlands, everything that relies on the wetlands for food or flood control, that sort of thing. Plus what we're putting back into the wetlands in terms of you know, pesticides, herbicides that run off the land into wetlands. We try to make those connections. I mean, we're dealing with fairly young kids here, so you don't want to get too preachy, but you want to get that connection made that, you know, between those wetlands are really important to the birds that we're going to go see later. We also do a big birdhouse building bee in April or so, because we need new birdhouses out there. Like the Bluebird Trail has been out there since 1969. The houses continue to deteriorate, and we need to replace them as we go as well. So there's always a big birdhouse building bee. We do a lot of stuff with birds. So we've gotten involved with the Christmas Bird Count for Kids, and that's basically a citizen science program where you're going out and counting birds and reporting back to Bird Studies Canada what you saw. And because it's not as hardcore as the adult Christmas bird count, we enjoy ourselves. We have cookies and hot chocolate as well along the way.
Nice.
That's good. We're big into biodiversity. We're always looking for different ways to study biodiversity. So coming up, we're now that we've got snow, it's going to be a little easier. We're going to look for tracks and scats and other signs of animals. So we're going to go and talk about how to identify tracks and scats and how that relates back to the fact that when you're studying biodiversity, you might not actually see anything, but you can see basically wildlife. We do a lot of fun things too. Like I said, I try to keep things on the scientific side as much as I can. And there's different members of the Nature Society, Martin Stoffel and Bruce Bolt, that are working with saw-whet owls. They have a banding station north of Saskatoon where they capture little tiny saw-whet owls in mist nets. So we go up to the banding station for about three or four times in the fall and learn about migration and how the scientists are studying the saw-whet owls that migrate through the area. That's exciting just because saw-whets have the cuteness factor that's, you know, 11 on a scale of 10. So it's it's always, always exciting.
We came across one in our, we live north of Lloyd, and there's a lot of bush in the back, and it was, I don't know, not very big. And the kids didn't know if it was real because it did not move. It just sat there. It's like playing a game of chicken with us. Like we could get so close that it wouldn't move at all.
They are the masters of camouflage, and even if you get really close, they're still pretty confident that you can't see them. Yeah. So you can get really, really close. And like I said, they're smaller than a pop can, so they're a cute little owl. Yeah,
that's cool. Yeah.
I really like the stories you're telling about connecting, I guess, real life scientists. I don't know what the right term is, about like connecting kids to actual science and the environment that they're in. Like that's, those are some really neat opportunities.
That's definitely part of it. Is I want to do more of the science of nature. There's a lot of different programs out there now where you can just get outside and you can do fun things outside. I want to try to keep the science level there as well too. So the you're learning about biodiversity while you're doing it, and you're learning how to record biodiversity and how to report it as well.
Why do you think, Greg, programming like that is it important for kids?
Really, it's everything's disappearing so fast these days. I mean, one of the reasons why I got so involved in being concerned about the environment was the places where my parents used to tromp around with me as a kid, canoeing and backpacking, they're not there anymore. You know, the one forest that I would explore as a kid is completely gone now.
Wow.
And as we get more and more and more urban, we're totally out of touch with how fast these areas are disappearing. And I want to make sure that kids know that this stuff is out there, and that when it disappears, that they're going to realize it's disappearing. That's, to me, really, really important, that you've got to be aware of what's there to be aware that it's disappearing.
Yeah, you can't care about preserving it or care about taking care of it if you don't even know it exists in the first place.
Exactly. Yeah. That's,
Have you seen a change in that awareness in kids or in the youth that you work with? You know, there's been a change over the last 30 years. You know, technologically and other things. Have you noticed a shift in kids?
Actually, I tend to attract the kids that are, or at least their parents anyway, are pretty concerned about it. And that seems to have rubbed off quite a bit on the kids. So I'm very, very lucky in that extent that I get kids that are actually really, really keen to do this kind of things. And what's really fun, I find too, is that occasionally, you know, the parents are really keen to show their kids these things. And I get kids that are like totally, they don't want to be here at all. They're like, why am I here? What have you done to me? You've taken me away from my screen time, my phone, and you're dragging me out here to look at, you know, birds or whatever.
Yeah.
And I what I love is when I get kids like that that absolutely don't want to be there. And then after 45 minutes, I can't get rid of them. They're hooked. I've got a fan for life now. That's the transition I like. But it's one of the biggest problems, I think, with the whole environmental education movement is we're still preaching to the converted. We tend to attract the people that are concerned, that want to learn more. It's the ones that don't even know this stuff exists. And I don't know how to reach those ones. That's the hard part. I think that's why I like working with the Zoo Society so much, because you just walk into a classroom full of everybody, you know, from people who are concerned about the environment to people who couldn't care less about the environment. And you walk in and you've got, a great horned owl along with you. Instantly, you've got their attention. And then once you've got their attention, you can just, we used to call it being subliminally subversive in a classroom situation like that. You reach people. The power of animals, zoos have so much potential to educate people about the environment without really being, without people really being aware they're being educated, because the entertainment factor is there as well. And it's one of the things that always bugged me. Well, I work for the Zoo Society, and it's a separate volunteer organization from the zoo that actually exists in Saskatoon. And the zoo proper and the zoo industry as a whole in Canada is pretty much into entertainment. Come look at the cute fluffy animals, and that's all they do. And they've got so much potential to actually do so much more, because once you've got people looking at whatever, the grizzly bear or the bald eagle or whatever, you've got so much potential once they're there to just feed them information on the environment and question them, get them thinking about things rather than just gawking at an animal. And I always find zoos just incredibly disappointing, because there's so much potential there and they're not using it.
It sounds like you've been in a lot of classrooms with a lot of different animals. Is there any really memorable experiences that you had doing that, of like the relationship with between kids and animals, or whatever their reaction might be?
The just about every time you walk in, and there's some animals that just, working with like snakes and things like that, the ick factor is there, where you walk into a classroom and there'll be a third of the classroom that is absolutely terrified of snakes. And then by the time you leave, they're all concerned people about reptiles and how to help reptiles and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. I always love that conversion that happened with people that would be just totally afraid of an animal going over completely to the opposite end, where they couldn't, this is now the best animal in the world for them, kind of thing. Lots of different stories like that.
That's pretty cool. I know my son, talking about birds, he was interested in birds, and it was somewhere around where there was, you were talking about the kids bird count, something like that. And we had printed off like this day, this GPS coordinate, here's, a 2-page like thumbnails of all the birds you might see. And he wanted to take it to school. And I just remember I dropped him off that day, and he had this like, folio of the birds that he was just sitting underneath a tree looking for birds. And I was so stressed. I was like, oh my gosh, this kindergarten kid, it's going to go so badly. And then like by the end of the day, when I picked him up, his teacher was like, the whole class just was like so excited about birds, just from this like one kid sitting and looking for birds with pictures of them. And it turned into like a 3-month thing that their class did, because they just like went off with all these birds. And it was so interesting. You've talked about kind of like the power of the animals and connecting that. And like, it is really cool to see that when that happens.
Yeah. Animals are always, they're just amazing to people. Like, I don't know, we've got hordes and hordes and hordes of deer in Saskatchewan. You see them everywhere you go, but regardless, every time I see one, it's like, oh, a deer. Oh my goodness. It doesn't matter. And birds are, very, very cooperative. Mammals tend to be a little bit more elusive. You don't see them very often. Birds are an easy thing for kids to get into as well. And like at a school, one of the things we do with schools or with young naturalists as well is just do a bird feeder. Kids love to pound nails. I love doing workshop with kids. Get some lumber, whack a bunch of lumber together with nails, build a bird feeder, put some bird seed in it, put it outside your window, and just see what comes. And you can get involved in, again, the citizen science programs like the Great Backyard Bird Count or Project Feeder Watch, again, where you can actually contribute to science, and that's always a big thing, but just watching the birds at a bird feeder, that is such a simple thing, and it's fun and it's engaging for classrooms. And you can take it from there. You can start recording which species come, how often they come. You can evolve that into math and graphing and art and photography. There's so many things you can do with just a simple bird feeder at a school. Mm-hmm. So it's fascinating. You never get bored with birds.
I also like that it's in that it's accessible in a way that some outdoor ed things are not accessible to all students or people of varying ages. That their interaction with nature might be through a window, and that's totally okay. And that is a valid way to like care about and observe nature.
Definitely. Yeah. Birds have that, like you say, the accessibility factor going for them.
Shall we loop back around to the Bluebird Trail? I know you've talked about it quite a bit. I know it's a big part of your life and has a long history. Is there anything more you want to share about it?
Well, the history part, I find quite fascinating. I need to actually study the history more. But basically, in the 1960s, junior Audubon societies and junior naturalist societies all over North America started doing these little bluebird trails. And Brandon, Manitoba, had a very, very active junior naturalist society. And they set up a bluebird trail. And they extended their bluebird trail, you know, the line of birdhouses, all the way to Broadview, Saskatchewan. From Winnipeg to Broadview, basically, was their bluebird trail. And then Lauren Scott, our, you know, former minister of the environment, back when he was like a grade 10 student in 1963 or whatever, he started the bluebird trail. And he's based out of Indian Head, and he connected the Brandon Trail, and he took it west all the way to Raymore, which is roughly halfway between Regina and Wynyard, kind of thing on the west side, east side of Last Mountain Lake. And then when the Saskatoon Young Naturalists came along, one of their first projects in 1969 was to build birdhouses. And they built like 450 birdhouses, and they connected Lauren Scott's trail at Raymore and took it all the way west, just to the west of Saskatoon, where another bluebird trail went from North Battleford to Langham. So now we had this bluebird trail that was almost 1,200 kilometers long, and kids monitoring all over Western Canada, this huge bluebird trail. It was really a neat project. The enthusiasm and energy of people back then, I still find amazing. When Mary Houston retired, I started banding with her in 2005, and I could hardly keep up with her. And when she retired in 2009, we actually got three more people to help out, to kind of fill in the gap that Mary left behind. So there was like, you know, Melanie Elliott and Tim Hoyen and Jan Shattuck and myself filling in, doing what Mary had done all by herself on this Bluebird Trail. We still couldn't do it all. So today I'm down to 250 birdhouses, and that's what I can manage easily or relatively easily with the kids going out. And I get such great kids. They get so into this, monitoring the Bluebird Trail. So we start around the end of May, and we're out about every second day, checking birdhouses, counting eggs, counting babies, identifying species. I love how kids can catch on so quickly. They can look at an egg and they can tell me whether it's a house wren egg or a tree swallow egg or a house sparrow or bluebird. It's just a really neat project to get kids involved into.
That's awesome.
So hands-on.
Yeah.
So Greg, the theme of our season for this season of podcast is connection to place. So I think you've kind of touched on this a bit, but I wondered if you might share with us, what do you think it means to be connected to place?
Wow.
And are there places that you feel real connected to?
Yes. And that changes too, because when I first started being involved in environment as a young lad, you know, hiking, canoeing, that sort of thing, I was very, very, had my blinkers on kind of thing. The environment to me, nature was mountains, rivers, forests. That was it. You know, it was that kind of thing. And it wasn't until I started doing work in the high Arctic that I realized you don't need trees to be in a really, really cool environment. And I really fell in love with the high Arctic. I'd love to go back, you know, in the summertime, anytime in the summer. Winters are kind of cold and windy,
yeah.
But summertime, the landscape is, it just comes alive with flowers, and it's totally just a beautiful, beautiful landscape, which it never ever dawned on me as a young person how beautiful grasslands were. Coming back to Saskatchewan and realizing that, oh, all this beauty that I had fallen in love with in the Arctic, this treeless landscape full of flowers, exists in the whole southern third of Saskatchewan, basically. You know, the grassland environment is just incredibly, from a aesthetic viewpoint, just incredibly beautiful and powerful. And then to find out it's disappearing so quickly, and then to realize as I started studying grasslands more and more and more, all the different connections from, you know, the loss of the bison to loss of habitat to just general loss of everything on the grasslands, and how much we've lost in Saskatchewan, it became really, really important to me to share what little grassland environment we have left with kids, especially, mm-hmm. so they know what we've got as well. Mm-hmm. So we spend a lot of time. We've got some really good conservation areas around Saskatoon. We've got things like Beaver Creek and Cranberry Flats and the Northeast Swale, little patches of native grasslands around. So we spend a lot of time on those areas as well. And part of the aim of the Young Naturalist Program is to show parents that these conservation areas exist, and you can go out there on your own anytime and explore them. Mm-hmm. But I also want to show kids that when we're out there, you know, we can look for things like the different flowers and different seasons. You know, if there happens to be, doing some things with kids is difficult. There's actually a lek, a sharp-tailed lek, on one of our conservation areas in Saskatoon. And I've taken a few people out there to, you know, getting up at sunrise kind of thing and tromping across the grasslands to watch the sharp-tailed grouse do their dance and that sort of thing, just to drive home how important these areas are to wildlife. And then we're always talking about with the kids too about how important the biodiversity is, and the fact that, hey, we're just another animal. We depend on a healthy environment to survive. And the best way to make sure the environment stays healthy for us is to make sure it stays healthy for all the other living creatures. So these areas that are remnants of our native grasslands, with the deer and the grouse and all the other animals and the ponds with their species and the bluebirds, all that biodiversity is just incredibly important to our survival. And that's the bottom line. You know, basically, it's one of the things I love explaining to kids is that, you know, every molecule in your body is made up of atoms that come from what you eat, what you drink, what you breathe, and that comes from where you live.
There we go.
There we go. Back.
There we go. Hi. We're back.
Was I just talking to myself there? Did any of that come through?
I think we got most of it, most, yeah, of it. And then we just lost, okay, you for a moment. We're like, wait, what happened then?
Never sure. I'm staring at a frozen face. And looking.
Yeah. Greg, is there anything else that you wanted to add that we didn't cover off today?
You were talking about interesting stories as well. And one of the fun things that we do as an art project for the Young Naturalists, we don't do it anymore because it just takes too much prep work. But we used to do paper making. We used to take old recycled paper and make new paper out of it, kind of thing. It's a basic project you can do just about anywhere in the in any class. But in the early 1990s, there was a forestry convention in Norway, and the person that was organizing the convention was fun. And he went out of his way and he sent out invitations that were made on paper that was made from moose poop. And I thought this was really cool because the term moose is basically translates roughly as the eater of twigs. And well, the way we make paper in Canada these days is you basically harvest a tree, put it through an incubator process, a process that pulp comes out the other end, and use that pulp to make paper. A moose does basically the same thing. It eats twigs on one end, it goes through a digestion process, and out comes a pulp-like material out the back end. So we would gather up all the moose poop we could find and then sterilize it completely and throw it in the blenders with our paper slurry as well, and make paper out of moose poop. And it became quite a big thing here with the local media and stuff doing interviews and that sort of thing. And for about 20 years, our moose poop paper was famous. It was one of the more unique crafts that we ever did. That was probably one of the more memorable things that the Young Naturalist accomplished, besides building, you know, thousands and thousands of birdhouses. Making paper out of moose poop was pretty cool.
It's amazing. That's awesome.
Do you want to say anything else while we're like in the podcasty part of it?
I don't know. I basically covered, you know, the history of who we are and the fact that we do all these neat programs. Trying to think what else we do. We do just a lot of field trips, you know, looking for migratory birds and all sorts of different, whatever we can see. We just do a lot of tromping around, you know, with the intention of maybe seeing an animal, but it really, we're just tromping, you know, going up to a local conservation area with an idea that we might see something. And if we do, great. If we don't, there's always going to be something there, you know, mm-hmm. whether we're chasing butterflies or sneaking up on frogs, there's always something that's going to happen that's going to be interesting. It's never boring being outside.
No, there's always something that you can explore. Well, Greg, then it's been awesome to chat with you and to spend some time with you today. Thank you so much for joining you. If anybody wanted to connect with you, is there a way that they could do that? Are you on the interwebs anywhere?
Sorry, say that again.
Is there a place online that people could find out more about you and or the Young Naturalists?
If they go to the Saskatoon Nature Society website, you can. There's a link there to the Saskatoon Young Naturalist on the Nature Society website, which is just saskatoonnature.org. And there's that's basically the web page that we have that tells you a little bit about who we are, what we do. I've got all the programs listed there for the year coming up that I can think of. And contact information is there as well.
Awesome.
Awesome. Thanks for joining us, Greg.
Well, thanks. This has been fun.
Leah, what did you have for takeaways on that?
I really enjoyed listening to Greg's stories and experiences, and I spent some time reflecting about the length of time that he's been working with the Young Naturalist program and other outdoor environmental initiatives with young people in Saskatchewan. And I thought about how many people there are who also have long histories and stories that would be great to capture. Sasco Doors has an award that not many people know about that's called the Melanson Award for people who have a lifetime of work in outdoor education. And it would be great to get some nominations in for some people for that award.
Yeah, no kidding.
What is your takeaway, Derek?
Well, one thing stands out to me, like I was trying to visualize a person like pitching to me, hey, you're going to put on this suit and you're going to climb up a tree to an angry bird of prey and take its babies and like band them. And like that seems so crazy to me. This like, it would be amazing to watch, but I don't think I would ever do it. I think that would be terrible. But I think Greg talked a lot about just the connection of everything and how everything is kind of interconnected. And I think that's been echoed by a lot of people that we talk to. And I think it's just something to kind of keep in mind that, you know, what we do affects other things. And I think that's something to think about today.
Yeah, the climbing the tree thing. I wanted to ask him like about horror stories, but I thought now's not the time or the place. But I'm sure there's lots.
Did you fall? Like, do you? What is that?
Your
like?
Eyes pecked out?
Yeah, like I gotta just gonna be on YouTube tonight looking up guys bird banding for falcons. See what happens.
Yeah, like mist nets and like little songbirds I can picture.
Yeah.
But climbing into a bird's nest, yeah. Not so much.
Going into an eagle nest. So
yeah,
good times. Well, thanks for listening today. If you have any ideas for future podcasts, send us an email, info@saskoutdoors.org, and stay tuned for more coming up this season. Have a great day.
This podcast is produced in association with Sask Outdoors. Check us out online at saskoutdoors.org.